Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWIT.
Bandwidth for the podcast version of Trey's Variety Hour is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
Okay, welcome everybody. I am Trey. I am mega excited about today's show. This is like very personal thing to me, but I hope you get a lot out of it too. So I'm super thrilled. I guess I should have shaved or something. I'm looking a little bit Clooney today, but it's nothing next to the facial fanghorn forest upon the face of Patrick Rothfuss here. Hey, Pat.
Hey there.
How are you?
Pretty good.
So that was a horrible introduction. I need to give you a proper introduction. I don't need to use some weak beard segue to introduce you. Let me give you a proper one. So this is Patrick Rothfuss, and I know people that tune in all the time. They're like, it should be a photography show or whatever. But you know, why is this guy on that uses his head to write words on a page? But people often ask me what inspires me. And I am generally inspired by things outside of photography, especially literature. And within that magisterium, one of my greatest influences over the past few years has been this man, Patrick Rothfuss. And it's like a great honor, and I'm humbled and a little bit nervous, actually, to have you here with me. So welcome.
You are terribly kind, and you give me way more credit than I deserve. I'm a little nervous too, if it makes you feel any better. This is literally, I've done two of these like live video things ever. And on one of them, I like fired it up and realized that I didn't have a webcam plugged in. And so there are the other two people going, "Hey, this is cool. It's Pat Rothfuss." And they're like, "We can't see you or hear you." And I'm trying to type stuff in. I'm like, "I can't find my webcam." So I'm relatively new to this whole thing.
All right. Don't worry about it. We're all learning as we go here. And also, I want to say hi to Tammy McLeod from Google. Hi, Tammy.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm pretty good.
Good. And like me, we've kind of stacked the deck here because you're another giant Pat Rothfuss fan.
I was very nervous when you asked me to be in this hangout.
Oh, don't be nervous. It's okay. Pat seems very nice. And also, Tammy has another claim to fame, which she's been too humble to say. Tammy not only is a great programmer at Google on the photos team, but she is also the world Sudoku champion.
U.S. champion.
U.S.
The U.S. is not the world.
Well, I think you would have won the world if that Romanian guy hadn't showed up.
Wow. Yeah.
Another claim to fame. So anyway, thank you, Tammy. And Tammy tonight is going to be watching the chat room, which is over here. This is a chat room that anyone can join that's watching. This is over on live.twit.tv. And if you have questions or thoughts or anything, pop in there. And Tammy's going to be monitoring that. And feel free to jump in anytime, Tammy. Okay?
Okay.
All right, cool. Well, Pat, I have all kinds of things that I wonder about with you. Because, you know, when you read somebody's book, you try to kind of intuit their soul through their work. and I think, you know, I think all artists are good students of the human condition. But I feel like for whatever reason, writers are even better students of the human condition because not only do you have to study it, but you have to be able to write about it. And I think the process of writing helps you to understand it even better. When you go through this with your various characters and as you come up with the arcs of these people, do you think of it in these terms?
That's an interesting question. I actually tend to think of it almost exclusively in terms of story. That's just sort of the it's sort of the language that I've developed to, you know, in my own head to talk about it with myself. A lot of other writers have these words that just, or these terms that don't make any sense to me, because like they grew up talking to other writers about writing, and I grew up kind of feral here in Wisconsin without a community of writers to hang out with and chat with about this stuff. So I think in terms of story, I do think about character a lot. It's interesting that you mentioned the human condition, because I read a really great quote once, and it was something along the lines of, there's a man walks down the street, and he thinks about how to write about a man walking down the street. And that person is a writer. And there's a different type of person, and that man walks down the street, and he wonders why people do the things they do. And he doesn't know. And so he guesses, and then he writes those guesses down, and that person is a novelist. And I read that, and I'm like, you know, that's kind of it. I kind of guess about why people do the things they do, and I put it in the context of this bigger story, and that's what I do, to put it in a very vague and ephemeral way.
Oh, that I understand. Since you are ultimately still analyzing and writing about the human condition through your various characters, you're also a human. You're self-analyzing everything you go through, and you're very, you're public. You share stuff on the internet, and you put stuff out there. So you have this body of work, this baby that you created, and when you put it out there, one half of you. I mean, if maybe you're like me. I don't mean to project my psyche onto you as an artist, but when you put something out there, you think, okay, this is my baby. I care about it. I love it. I don't care if anyone likes it. It's important to me. I really care for this thing. I could care less what the world thinks of it. And that's a very strong feeling. And then the other feeling you have is, oh my gosh, I hope people love it. I'll be crushed. I'll be devastated if people don't like it, you know? So how can both of these things be true for one human?
It's a huge, like, cognitive divide, and you're absolutely right. I remember the moment at which I decided, you know, somebody pointed at the very first page of the novel as it stood, like, 10 years ago, or 10 years before it was actually published, and they go, you know, you use the word alloy and counterpoint here, and those are two, he goes, not only are you mixing a metaphor, which you shouldn't do, but these are two specific terms from two very different disciplines, and that might really throw some people off. And I remember thinking, if that's going to be a deal breaker for people, then they might as well find out on the very first page of my novel. It's like, if you can't, right. If you either don't know the word alloy or you're not willing to look it up, you will not enjoy my book. And so, like, here's your warning. You can get out now cheap. And I remember thinking, and that kind of started me along the lines of thinking, who's this for? How much do I want to cater to, not to my audience, but to my imagined audience? And I realized that I would much rather write a book that some people would love and some people would hate than maybe try to write one that everyone would feel pretty okay about.
Mm-hmm.
And I consciously made that choice, which is kind of the same thing as like saying you don't really care,
right.
How people think about it. But then at the same time, I mean, you know what it's like. You get feedback on your art, and it makes you mental. I mean, sometimes you get like a really sweet letter or a note or a comment, and you're like, wow, I've made this, I've improved this person's day. And then you get somebody make a comment, you know, just kind of very dismissive, or they're critical, or they're an idiot, you know, and And you're filled with this rage. And you're like, I thought that I was better than this. I thought I didn't care. I thought I was writing it for other reasons. But it doesn't matter. It still gets under your skin somehow.
It does. It really does get under your skin. And, you know, you think that, you know, artists are tough or whatever. I was watching an interview with Penn Jillette, you know, from Penn and Teller.
Yeah.
Who, you know, appears to be like just tough as nails and he can care less about anybody, right? And I've always kind of respected that because, you know, he's in his own world. He just doesn't care. But then I saw him interviewed like, I wasn't watching The View. It might have been The View. I don't watch that show. But and so he was talking to Joy about something and he asked her, he said, doesn't it bother you when people say bad things about you? And she said, no, it really doesn't. He goes, really? He goes, because whenever I hear anything bad, it just drives me nuts. It's all I can do not to think about it. Like, he looks at tweets before he goes out on his nightly Vegas show. And if there's one negative tweet about him, it's all he can think about in his head.
Yeah, I get it. And, you know, having read some of the stuff that he's written, I can buy that. You know, because he does. He looks, first off, he's big. And he's a good talker, and he's very articulate and very sure of himself. So you assume that he's kind of like a pillar of ego and you know, self-reliant, you know, self-assurance. But I've read some of his stuff where he talks about just little day in the life, you know, back before he hit it really big. And, you know... Everybody's kind of a regular guy underneath it all, but you know, some of his writing from about that time, you're like, yeah, this is a guy who kind of gives a damn. I think it's hard to be a certain kind of artist and not give a damn, because without empathy, it's probably fair to say that without empathy, there is no art, or rather, like, without empathy, you have a very, very specific and strange kind of art.
Right.
Or maybe more specifically, without empathy, you can't have a certain type of artist, no matter what that art is, whether that art is a performatory art, a creative art, a visual art, a linguistic art. Because we are trying to make connections with other human beings. And if you don't understand, if you don't at least put some thought into what other people are like, that empathy thing doesn't work. That inner connection, that expression, that communication, that you can say art is about communication of one sort or another. And that it always ties back to empathy. And if a person doesn't have empathy, It's hard to make that communicative art. But of course, if you have a big heap and helping of that in your personality, that leaves you more vulnerable to these things like a one-star Amazon review that just absolutely takes a crap on your day.
Yeah. I think that of the various people that are experimenting with art, and there's more and more artists out there now, and I think that's great, of course, but of the people that are playing with it, if one of those things, either not caring what people think, if that is so much stronger than actually really being a little bit worried about what people think, as soon as one of those gets too big, it might send you kind of spiraling out of control and into a bad artistic place.
I think you're right. I think you're right, which is hearing you say that makes me feel better, because it feels like I should be in one camp or the other. It's nice to think that my inability to place myself in one camp or another is a sign of balance rather than just indecision.
Yeah, I think it is balance. So these people that, you know, give you this, it sounds like you get the same, I didn't picture it, but I guess you get the same kind of feedback photographers get, where you get helpful people that are giving you advice on your book, right? And they say, you know, Pat, this is a mixed metaphor. So, you know, these comments, they always come off incredibly condescending, don't they? How do you respond to that? And what do you do with this kind of condescending feedback?
Well, you know, and that's just it. It does. It comes off as as rude or brusque or condescending or insulting or what's the other word I'm looking for? Patronizing. Right. But of course, I think it's never intended that way. It's always, what happens is usually these people have experienced a sensation of connection with the art, and then they make the transference from the art into the artist, and so they feel a connection with you, which means effectively you're their friend, which means they have the ability to speak very freely and clearly to you. And a friend would say, hey, your fly is down. Hey, you've split an infinitive. Hey, yeah, that's a mixed metaphor. And admittedly, when I'm looking for that criticism, it's really nice because I honestly don't know what a split infinitive is. And so when somebody points it out to me, I'm like, oh, I learned something. But when it comes just in a random piece of fan mail, I'm kind of like, it does. It makes you pull back and you're like, whoa.
Yeah.
This isn't a first date conversation. I don't know you that well.
Yeah, you're a little more generous than I am. I think what happens with these people is that they, I don't know if it's a tone of familiarity that they're immediately jumping to, or if this is just how they really think that they're being helpful, and they say things in a very stark, simple way with no humor, with no lightness, but they don't see that. I don't know if it's sort of some sort of email Asperger-y syndrome or something, right? Or if they're just trying, they really think they're being helpful. And I think as artists, we just take it, we're so defensive. We're like, oh, say it in a nicer way, please.
Well, you know, I will take starkness over the winking smiley face. Because if somebody is like, you know, boy, you should really learn what a sentence fragment is, winking smiley face. Don't you dare come around my place with a winking smiley face and pretend that we're just funning around. No.
Hilarious.
Or JK, you know? oh, just joking. Nah, don't start that with me.
Hey, Tammy, anything popping up in the chat room?
There's been one question so far that's pretty good. This person asks, what is your actual motivation for writing the books? Do you do it for the money, for yourself, to prove some point? I find it amusing how you really don't seem to care much about the publishers or even fans sometimes. So why do you do it?
Wow, there's a whole lot of subtext in that question. Seems like I don't care about my publisher or fans. Is that what it says?
That's what it said, yes. I'm just quoting the question.
That person has leapt to a lot of very interesting conclusions based on whatever information they've managed to gather. Boy, it's just, I'm a little stunned by that. I don't care about my publishers or my fans.
Well, the essence of the question is, why do you write?
Why do I write? And actually, you know, that it actually touches on what you were talking about before, where a lot of times, you know, the real content of the messages people send us is, why do you write? Or, I love your book. Or, you're a great photographer. And then there's that little side comment that absolutely derails us, which is right. What's happening just here. Why do I write? I like telling stories. Ultimately, that I could talk about a lot of other things, but that's what it all boils down to. It's obviously not for the money, because I worked on my first book for 14 years before it was published, you know, and so if I was looking to be rich, then that would be like the dumbest way ever to pursue it. You know, I mostly do it because I've always enjoyed reading these books. I've always thought it would be fun to write the books. And it was. It was really, really enjoyable to take this time writing these books and creating this world and doing that. Just the act of creation itself was a lot of fun. if it wasn't, I wouldn't have stuck at it for 14 years without any, you know, really notable outside reinforcement.
So when did you know, when did you feel that you were born to write? Because, you know, reading your book, and there's a few other authors that I do this, when I just start just flowing with the prose, I think, oh my gosh, this person was, they were put on this earth to write. And you know, when you're seeing someone in their element, you know, when someone is doing, you know, they're just perfectly in the zone. Did you have hesitation the whole time, or was there always just a sort of, you know, gentle throb in the back of your skull, like, oh, this is really me?
My pat answer to that is I've never known that I wanted to be an author or to be a published whatever or a writer. I know that I like to write, but I never felt like, and I always thought that it would be cool to be published, but I never ever thought this was like what I was born for, this was my destiny or something like that. See, again, if I had thought that after 14 years of not being published, you know, I would have killed myself way before then. You know, and I think that tends to be the result when a lot of people, they're like, I'm going to get published. I know that I'm going to do it. I want to do this for a living. I want to be a writer. And so they try, and like after 3 or 4 years, they end up like, they're not published yet. Then they end up like really bitter and twisted up, and yeah. And you can read their blogs and they're just angry and they got all this bile. Whereas like, I never expected to be published. I was just having a good time. Yeah. Well, think of it like this. Do you garden by any chance?
No.
I don't.
But I do know a bunch of bitter photographers that fit the mold you're talking about.
Yeah, because they expect to hit it big or to be famous or to make a ton of money. But if you think about it, a gardener never thinks, I will be famous for my garden. You garden because you love being outside and you love digging in the dirt. And either you love flowers or fruit, whatever sort of thing you're gardening for. And none of them ever after 3 years like gets bitter and is pissed off that they're not on the cover of Better Homes and Gardens. You know, right. It's a hobby. It's something they do for the joy of the act of it, not for some sort of external reinforcement later on. And in all honesty, I found the level of external reinforcement I've received paralyzing at times. It freaks me out, especially after so long of effectively working in a vacuum.
So what was it like? You know, you said you were kind of feral out in Wisconsin and you're not part of the establishment and all this stuff. And it, you just blow onto the scene a few years ago and make a you know, you're not the kind of person that makes a spectacle of yourself, but the work made a spectacle of itself. And, you know, what is it like being, because this is very useful to, I think, other artists from various other industries that come into an already mature industry that's already well established, and you're this new fresh face, and you just blow into the scene and everything changes and goes crazy. What's that been like for you?
This is the sort of thing where it's like, I can give the correct Hollywood interview answer, which is to say, well, and really that's almost the polite thing to do, because everyone wants to think like, wow, after working for so long, he finally made it. Now he's making grown-up money and people kind of know who he is, and he's finally achieved his dream. That's like the satisfying story. But the truth is, the level of success that I reached has at varying times made me like profoundly unhappy. Mm. And that's kind of a sad thing to say. And people are like, oh, boy, you know, sorry, we love your book. I don't mean to imply that. It's just that I was really good at being a broke, nobody college student. And so I go from that to suddenly being, you know, a moderately well-known fantasy author. And I get fan mail and people want me to come to conventions and I do a signing and 900 people show up. And so, a woman gets to the front of the line and she shows me she's got like my name tattooed on her arm. And I'm like, you know, that's, I didn't have like the mental equipment to deal with that. It's, I mean, in some ways, this would be way easier if it happened when I was 19 years old. Because when you're 19 years old, you firmly believe that like you should be the center of the universe. And so if somebody had said, poof, you're a famous author and people love you and here's some money, I would have like bought a fast car and felt like a rock star. And now it happens and I'm like, this is weird. And I feel guilty.
Yeah. I could sense that. I sense that guilt, not with you. I sense it with a lot of Hollywood stars, right? That they've gotten very famous. They've gotten a lot of money and then they just feel guilty and they end up just doing a bunch of strange things because of the guilt. So I hope you don't get like that.
I'm trying to ride the brake on the strange thing element. Although it's fair to say that, whatever stress I might feel as a fairly successful fantasy author, like the most famous author ever is not as famous as the least famous movie star ever. So it's like, I can't imagine what sort of stressors those folks are going through. In some way though, I think that it's more akin to winning a lottery. And I've read some research into that, where sometimes people who win, actually 9 out of 10 people who win like a big $1 million lottery wish that it had never happened to them 10 years after the fact. It destroys their lives because they don't have the tools to deal with that sort of thing. And so it wrecks everything for them.
There's an interesting TED talk about that. They compare like lottery winners to paraplegics, and generally, the paraplegics are much happier. They don't necessarily equate it to having a lot of money, but it's the problem of having many, many choices.
Yeah.
And as you have so many things you could be doing with your time and your life and your money, no matter which path you choose, there's always an option to go choose a different path. So, like, if you look at games, you know, you're a gamer. Like, you know these games where you have to commit to being a night elf, right? If you can't ever change, you will really strongly defend how awesome a night elf is. No matter what choice you make, your brain starts making all these justifications because of limited choice, you can become happier.
That's a great comparison. And I think it is true. For a while I said no to everything. I got invited to like cool anthologies. And I tried to be a grown-up, and I'm like, no, I have to work on book two because people really want book two, and book two is late. And I felt like the kid who's like inside practicing his violin when all of his friends are outside playing. And so I realized that was not a good way to maintain my emotional stability. And so I said, okay, I'm going to do some of the fun stuff now that book two is out. And unfortunately, book two made enough of a splash that I've been getting like really cool offers. Like, I turned down the opportunity to like help write and design a video game based on my world. Like, I've always wanted to do this. And I think it would be really cool. But I can't do that and do a good job on my book and finish the novella and the two stories that I've already promised people, and be a dad, you know, and still like occasionally see the few remaining friends that still live in the state. And so I had to say no to that, and it sucks. That's a really interesting comparison.
Well, I don't know if it's accurate or not. It's how I think about it. I find all ways to justify my strange activity. So, considering your books, Tammy, by the way, get another question ready. Find one less insulting this time.
It wasn't insulting. I was just curious about. It's always fascinating to me to find out what people are kind of assume
the,
about.
The other people in the chat already jumped to your defense.
Oh, they're very sweet.
They did. I saw them jump to your defense too. Okay, while you find another question,
the chat were very ready to jump to your defense.
I have one for you here. Okay. So now you have to be very, reflective here about your own work, and I know you are very humble, and that's very nice and everything. But just setting that aside, I'm talking about yourself in the third person or whatever.
Okay.
I get so many suggestions of books to read, of movies to watch, of places to go. And by far, I get more recommendations to read your books than anybody. And there's a lot of great books out there. There's a lot of great writers. There's all kinds of wonderful prose. But what do you have any insight as to what it is about the nature of your stories that is so incredibly word of mouth? It's weird how anomalous it is.
And honestly, that's the only reason anybody knows about me, is because people have liked the book well enough to tell their friends about it. Odds are that's how, I don't know, three quarters of the people who know about my book and have read it have found it, is just from people recommending it or talking about it or writing blogs about it. In some ways, I think it's because of the choice that I made when I started out, that I wanted people to either love the book, and if I lost some people early on and they hated it, that was fine. So I was aiming up here. I wanted people, if they liked it, to really like it. And if they didn't like it, then hopefully they would get out and cut their losses. And generally speaking, whoops, it looks like we lost.
Lost Tammy.
Oh, no.
Should come back.
Come back, Tammy. We miss you. See, I'm so distractible, I forgot what I was talking about. Right. Generally speaking, I think if you're exposed to a piece of art and you like it, you like it. And then you go on with your life and you don't think about it again. If you really like it, maybe if it comes up in conversation the next day, then you'll mention it to the person you're having a conversation about. But then there are the people that I consider the missionaries, where you find something, and whether it be a movie or a story, it gets inside you, and you almost can't help but like talk to people about it.
It gets right
inside you, and you almost can't help.
Uh-oh. Hey, Tammy, you've got some audio feedback there. It's throwing us for a loop. Okay, she's been muted.
But as to like why my book managed to hit that mercenary impulse in some people, not mercenary, missionary impulse, I think it might be because, for one, I did get a chance to take 14 years and really like make it as good as I possibly could. Mm. Most authors nobody has that luxury, you know?
Right.
Because they're trying to make a living or sell their book. Whereas I was perfectly happy to dink around and be a half-time teacher for my whole life. Also, I think that in terms of like what is good in my book, I think it's that people like the characters. Mm-hmm. And the characters seem real to them. And I'm pretty good at putting words together. People who like my books tend to be word geeks to one degree or another. Those are two common features that I've discovered.
Have you you seem pretty accustomed to talking about your own work. Is this something you've had to come to learn? I've always had great difficulty talking about my photos. I don't always know either what people want to hear, or sometimes I just don't like to say anything. I just want them to interpret it. So how have you come to talking about your own art in this sort of clinical but passionate way?
Well, in some ways, it's way easier for me because my work is, I don't want to say verbal, because it's not really verbal, but it's a word-based art. And so talking about stories using stories, you'll notice that I can't actually seem to just answer a question. I always tell a little story to answer the question.
Yeah.
I have a bit of an advantage there, whereas what you're doing is, really the ultimate in visual art, and it's not meant to be digested in a verbal way. And so even trying to discuss it in a verbal way kind of against... We have two Tammies.
Oh, yeah, two Tammies, and one of them is noisy.
But the other thing is it's easy for me to actually talk about this stuff because this is what I think about all the time. I think about stories and how they fit together and characters and all this stuff, and I'm alone, in pursuit of my art for a lot of it. I mean, I'm trapped in a room typing for 12 hours a day sometimes. And so then when I get a chance to actually share my theories with people, it's kind of fun because so much of the rest of my job is really not a social one. Do you run into that as well? Where, is your art, do you consider it more solitary or more social?
Well, I'm incredibly solitary. Like, for example, I've never been to a photography convention. I never really read a photography book or went to a photography class. And I know that there are, hundreds of thousands of photographers that get together and compare their craft and go to conventions and this and that. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And maybe this is in my own head, but I feel like by almost carving myself off, I'm able to spiral out and go off in probably errant directions a lot of the time. I do come up with unique stuff. And I think that just by being around the group think that no matter how independent of an artist you are, it can be accidentally a little bit insidious, and it can change your thought patterns. Because if other people are sitting there, let's say they're talking about something like color calibration on your monitor, even if you're not concerned about it, if there's a whole lot of conversation about color calibration, you might start to think, oh, I guess that's pretty important. Maybe I should think about that.
I think you're absolutely right. I think community is very comforting, but I think it has a huge homogenizing effect. I ran into, this was very early on when I started going to a few conventions, and I ended up at a table, and all these people knew each other, and they were kind of part of the same writing group. And they started talking about Mary Sue characters. And, they were talking, and everyone's like, oh, Mary Sue. Oh, actually, it came about because somebody had read my book. I'd only been out for maybe a couple of months, and I was nobody. But a guy had read my book, or an ARC of it, and he goes, that was a pretty good book. He goes, your main character's a bit of a Mary Sue. And everybody started talking. And then I said, what's a Mary Sue? And everybody at the table looked at me like I said, like, what's a dog? Or like, what's water? And they all started to explain to me that Mary Sue's always the best. And Mary Sue is so good at everything and blah, 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 blah. And they were all in complete agreement with each other in this group mind they had. And I remember thinking, and they beat up the concept of this extremely competent character to such a vicious degree. And, you know, and I'm nobody. I'm just kind of like tagging along to dinner with these people. So I kind of nodded and smiled. But all I could think was, man, I never want to read anything that you guys write, because the violent reaction to that Mary Sue character is obviously this useless, whiny gimp character that I've seen so much of. And I'm like, a lot of my favorite characters possess these characteristics that people use to define them as Mary Sue. It's like Cyrano de Bergerac, Odysseus, right. I mean, like Gandalf, you know, are they all Mary Sues just because they're so hyper competent? But I think you're right. If I'd grown up, or if I'd learned to be a writer going to these conventions and being exposed to those ideas, it would have steered me away from writing Quoth, this main character, the way that I did. And I think that would have been a real shame. I mean, there's nothing wrong with an exceptional person. That I want to read books about exceptional people.
Yeah, that's very well said. I'm glad to see that exists in other things besides photography. I know it also exists in games, because I was in Iceland, and I was talking with Hilmar, who's one of the heads of this game company called CCP. They make EVE Online. Mm. And EVE Online is a massive multiplayer online game. It's out in space. It's a beautiful game. It's very different, super hardcore. It's much different than World of Warcraft. It's very much its own thing. It's incredibly successful. It's been growing steadily over time. They're very profitable. They've been going for 6 or 7 years. And I remember I asked him, I said, why is your game so different? Why is it so successful? Why is it just on its own, this pillar of awesomeness? And he says, oh, it's because we're in Iceland. It's because we're very cut off. We don't really understand what happens in the rest of the world. We just make stuff that we think is awesome. And then, you know, back here in the States and everywhere else, you just see clones come out of World of Warcraft, and Star Wars looks like kind of the same game with a few bells and whistles. And yeah. And I think it is important to be independent, although I hate to give this advice to up-and-coming artists not to talk to other artists, but in some ways I think that everybody inside just knows what's beautiful and knows what's right, and by working at it on your own, you can come to these truths and then express them in your own unique way.
I think the exact same thing, where so often it's when you're just starting off, it's so easy to get disheartened with your own lack of success or your lack of knowledge of your craft. In my view, it ends up being actually almost like a religious issue, where when you're just starting off as a human being, like you're just growing up, you can't really form these abstract, ethical, cosmological concepts by yourself. And so if somebody says, you know, there's a big man with a beard in the sky and he says what's right and wrong, and you just freaking do it, and you're like, okay, that's good to know. There's right and there's wrong. And then you absorb that because that's what you do. Boy, I'm going to tangent myself off into just in all sorts of bizarre directions here. And I'm talking about religion, which you should never do. But what happens is you absorb that stuff early on, because we're all sponges early on. And if creatively you want to sign on to effectively the artistic version of a religion, a lot of people do that. They want to paint like Monet or Picasso, or a type of Picasso because he changed all the time, or you want to write like Faulkner, or you follow in the footsteps of Stephen King or any of these people who write these writing books, like whoever wrote Writing Down the Bones or whatever, or T.S. Eliot, or you want to be a postmodernist, or you care about Derrida. In my opinion, those people find this thing and they follow the dogma of that particular creative religion, and they don't bother thinking very much for themselves. And that can lead to some very good art, but it is always going to be art or thought along that particular line, in that particular mold. And if you do it all yourself, you have it, it's double or nothing. You're going to make something new and that's your own, and maybe it's awesome. But the downside there is maybe you make something new and it's all your own and it really sucks. It is. It's absolute double or nothing. I remember, you know, I made such huge mistakes over those 14 years. I thought, I don't want to have a villain. And so I got rid of the whole concept of a villain from my book. And it took me like 3 or 4 years to realize that while a villain really wasn't good, an antagonist is very useful. And like, that's something I could have learned very easily in a month talking to experienced writers. And so that cost me a lot of time and energy. And so I ended up reinventing the wheel a lot on my own. But some of those wheels that I invented, they're very firmly mine. And I know them in a way that I never would have known them if I just learned it out of some writing handbook.
No, you came to it in your own way. So it had a very strong foundation that wasn't based on what someone else told you. The same thing happened to me with f-stops and ISO, and because I just figured it out with a camera. I had my own internal actuarial table of aperture and ISO and shutter speed, and I just knew intuitively that if I were to cut my f-stop in half, it would cut my shutter speed in half. And I just knew these things, and I went speaking to a group of people, and I put up a photo, and they said, "What f-stop did you shoot that at?" And my whole life flashed in front of my eyes. I thought, "Oh, I guess that's very important. I guess that's the thing that really makes this photo." And then I thought, suddenly, I don't really actually know how people learn photography. When I answered the question, I realized I could have said, "I shot this at f/4," and everyone in the class would have nodded and said, "Yeah, f/4. That sounds about right."
Would have
written, or I could have said f/22. And they all would have said, "Yeah, that sounds about right." Right? And it made me realize how shallow their actual knowledge of the fundamentals are. And not that my way is better or worse, but it made me, like, I don't really understand how people learn anything. And I think to have it be really strong, you have to come at it in your own way, from your own angle.
I think that, of course, I'm partial to it because that's how I did it. And, you know, it built character. There's no denying that. And sometimes people used to say, "Should I go get an MFA and learn how to do creative writing?" And I would say, "You know, you can learn it yourself. Like, go out into the, go onto the mountain and just write." But, you know, the truth is, there are some really bang up writers who got their MFAs and learned their craft. You know, Jim Butcher, Brandon Sanderson, Nnedi Okorafor all got their MFAs, and they're like really good writers, and they write much more consistently than I do. Butcher turns out a book a year, like clockwork. Sanderson writes like 2 huge books a year, making me look like an absolute piker. You know, I put out a big book every couple of years because, like, my creative process is all made out of, like, duct tape, spit, and binder twine. I can't necessarily say that's the best way to do it. It's just the way that's ended up working for me.
Yeah, I don't mean to shortchange any other photographers that know this stuff inside out the classical way, because they are amazing photographers. And I think that you can go through the normal way of learning things and still be independent and come to know each of these foundational things in your own way. But I think it does take a certain type of person to really re-examine all these foundations.
I think you're absolutely right.
Butcher, and I mean, anyone that can write 13 Dresden files in 13 years is, they know.
He's a machine. I'm such a geek for his books these days.
Yeah. Hey, Tammy, what do we have brewing over there? Give us a good one this time that doesn't ruffle our sensitive friend here.
Hello?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, are you on a satellite?
A couple of people wanted to know what your inspiration was. I'm in my bedroom, actually.
The inspiration question always stumps me because I feel like I should say, I read Madeline L'Engle as a kid, and that's when I decided I wanted to be an author. But I never really had something like that. I read a lot of really good books, and when I read a really good one, I thought, wow, it would be awesome to write a book this good. I didn't think...
I heard a rumor that your books were based on a D&D campaign.
No,
true?
No, no. The very first book I wrote in high school, I based on a D&D campaign. And that was like a horrible, horrible first novel. It had like a barbarian and a monk and a Catman samurai in it. It was so bad. It was so bad. I learned a lot right in that book.
That's hilarious.
Do you have any authors that particularly inspire you as well?
I inspire. I love the word inspire because it implies so much. It comes. I'm pretty sure it's Latin. It's in spiritus. It means to actually get a spirit inside you. But in terms of like having an inspiration, again, I get fidgety and say, I don't know if these people were like a spirit that was inside me and then I had to breathe it out. That's creepy. But there are some authors that I admire the hell out of. And I've already mentioned Jim Butcher. Brandon Sanderson writes a hell of a book. The Mistborn trilogy is great. And what he did moving from Mistborn to Alloy of Law, I don't think anyone has ever done in the genre or even considered doing in the genre. Writing a secondary world fantasy that moves from the medieval time period to the modern time period in the same world, nobody has ever done that before. Mm-hmm. It takes a special mind to think of that. You have to read Peter S. Beagle's The Last Unicorn. Neal Stephenson, Snow Crash, and Zodiac, and you know those books were great. I could kind of just rattle off a thousand books, but I don't think people would want to sit still for all of that. Warren Ellis's stuff, he does graphic novels. Transmetropolitan, I think everyone should read it. That was a fabulous set of graphic novels. Neil Gaiman, Terry Pratchett. Those are the kings and crown princes of fantasy. If you haven't read The Last Unicorn, a Neil Gaiman novel, and a Terry Pratchett novel, then you cannot consider yourself well-read in fantasy. And it's likely that you've been living under some sort of heavy rock, too.
Cool, thanks. Hey, one final question, but before that, why don't you talk a little bit about your charity effort and how that's gone crazy and what people can get. We still have a day to give money and what it's all good for and this sort of thing.
Yeah, it used to be that writing was my hobby and I would do it for fun instead of like doing work or, reading up for my classes or doing homework. And then suddenly my hobby became my job. I had to write as my day job. And so I ended up kind of accidentally running a charity called World Builders, which sort of bands geeks together and everybody donates money. Authors and publishers donate books. And so if you donate money to World Builders, we'll match it. We'll match 50% of it. And you get a chance of winning some of these signed books or rare books from a bunch of cool sci-fi and fantasy authors. And at the end of it, all of the money goes to Heifer International, which is in my opinion, the best charity around. They do good work all over the world, in the U.S., in Asia, in Europe, in Africa, providing sustainable life. They give people a leg up so that they can improve their lives and have better food and lifestyle choices for the rest of their lives. It's not just giving people a bag of rice and keeping them fed for a month.
That's great. And you've exceeded expectations this year, it looks like.
This has been a very good year. I was kind of hoping we could maybe hit $250,000. And we passed that very handily yesterday. We're already past 275. I haven't clicked on the update yet. I'm going to go
up right now. I checked it. I think we're at 280 now. You're awesome.
Good Lord. It is. It's still rocketing up. We have a full day to do a little bit more. And so if anyone out there is interested, you can head on to my blog. Just Google Pat Rothfuss and you'll find my blog pretty easily, or Google World Builders. And you can go, you can see like the thousands of books that people have donated, many of them from authors. They're signed or their first editions or their limited editions. And head on over there. If you donate, we'll match 50%, so your money is worth more. And you might get a chance of winning something cool on top of it. It's kind of a win-win.
Cool, excellent. I want everyone to do that too. Okay, one final kind of familial question about your new child. So how old now?
Oh, yeah. He is a couple of months past 2 years old.
And, I have three kids myself, and it's hard for me to remember what I did before I had kids. But what now that you're kind of experiencing this child, right? Is it changing how you think about world building as you see everything kind of coming out of this kid, and as he experiences the world, and as he starts to kind of build his own world in his head? Is it influencing a little bit of book three in sort of a roundabout channeled way?
Well, it's probably fair to say that yes. I mean, he's influencing me. I tell you, since I've had the kid, I'm not sure about the biology, but I guarantee some sort of hormonal switch has been flipped in my head where certain things are just not cool anymore. Like if I see a news story or I hear something happening to a kid, it was always horrible before, but now it's at this whole logarithmically more important thing in my head. I am soppy now. I used to make fun of my mom. She would like cry at a phone commercial, you know, where somebody's calling home to grandma. And God, I am such a soppy git lately where I get weepy over anything. It would be kind of classic to say, oh, he makes me want to make the world a better place. But, you know, no, I wanted to make the world a better place before. I think we all should want to do that regardless of whether or not we have a stake in the future. That just makes us good, responsible human beings. You don't do it because suddenly you have a kid and now it's important. You do it because, like, you should fucking cowboy up and be a responsible member of the human race. I'm sorry. Should I have not have cussed a little bit? I made it almost to the end before I cussed. I'm assuming you can bleep that out or something.
Don't worry about it.
Sorry. But yeah, he has. If, you know, in some of the later books, we'll probably see, in some of the stuff I write from now on, we'll probably see more kids, because now I can write a realistic kid. Whereas before, I just didn't have a very good grasp of any of that. But on the other hand, I've always been irritated when somebody's written a book and like the main character has a cat that's really important. And all I can think is, oh boy, I wonder if the author has a cat that they really love. So you're probably not going to see like an adorable two and some change stand in for my baby in some book coming up. That's not so much.
Well, Pat, you were awesome. Thank you. Thank you a lot. It was meaningful to me. I hope, I'm sure a lot of people got a lot out of it. So,
well, no, this was cool. And it's nice to hear your angle on this stuff, too, because you brought up some stuff that makes good sense in my head. It makes me think that I may be not quite so crazy.
No, you're just the right amount of good crazy. Perfect. All right. Well, thanks very much. Thanks, everyone in the chat room, and thanks, everyone watching live. And if you want to find out more about Pat, your blog is at?
Looks like blog.patrickrothfuss. If you just search Rothfuss, there aren't very many of us out there. You can find me off that.
All right. And very early on in Google Plus, you proclaimed yourself the mayor.
Oh, the king. Man, I forgot about that.
Yeah.
When Google Plus launched, I did. I declared myself king. And so I think I have dibs on that.
Yeah.
Unless there's a violent coup of some sort, I probably do still hold that title.
Yeah. I got your back. All right, cool. Thanks, everybody. And thank you, Pat. And thanks, Tammy. And thanks, Tony and chat room and everybody. I appreciate you very much. And we'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye. I'm sorry. I'm so rambly.
No, you're not. What do you mean? You're fantastic.
I tend to kind of hold forth on subjects when I know it can be nicer to have kind of little bite-sized answers. I apologize for that.
Just so you're aware, Pat, we are still on the air even though the show's over. Just so you know.
That's cool.
Just so you know.
That is a good heads up, though. I'll still try to keep the violent cussing to a bare minimum.
No, the thing is, Pat, you probably, I don't know if you realize this or not, but when you admire somebody, either just a little bit or a whole lot, you just love to hear them ramble. You know, it's almost like this just stream of this Faulkner-esque type, you know, consciousness, and it's wonderful, actually.
It's true. I could listen to Neil Gaiman talk for hours and hours, you know, about how stories fit together in his head. It's just fascinating to me.
You know, there is a... you might like this being a student of language and words. There's this book I read. I forgot what it was. I'll think of it while I'm telling you about it. But in World War II, the British went down to this African tribe, okay, because they wanted to come up with a secret language so they could communicate and it couldn't be, you know, an Enigma machine by the Nazis or anything. And so they found these this tribe that communicated with drums. Okay, that's how they communicated. And so it was great because they could go over long distances and communicate ideas and thoughts and whatever. So they sat there with this tribe and they started to realize that different patterns meant like the men are out on a hunt. And then when the men were out on the hunt, the women back in the village would say, they would start playing on the drum and they would say, the kids are down by the stream, dinner is almost ready. Come back soon. And they would repeat this about 10 or 15 different ways until everyone got the message, right? It was almost like a song that repeated key words in sort of a random way. And as it was repeated over and over again, the entire sentence was communicated. So from this, they came up with the notion that the number of discrete words in a language, you would have to rearrange them a number of ways to communicate a certain idea. And so the thing is with English is that because even though we have a vast, wonderful vocabulary, we don't quite have all the words we need to communicate an idea. So you have to take some of the same words and rearrange them in sort of a sing-songy way. And only by repeating them in a sing-songy way can you communicate a complex idea. And I think that's what comes out with the rambling.
That makes me feel better about very rarely having like a quick, pithy answer. I can't remember who first pointed it out to me, but I was doing an interview and I think we were actually recording it. And they were thinking, they said, oh, we'll just grab a quick 20-minute interview and then we'll edit it together later. And so we do it. And it went on for like almost an hour and change. And we got done and they're like, wow, that was a lot of fun. I'm like, yeah, I'm sorry. And they go, no, it's really interesting. You tell stories and stories and stories. And I go, do I? And I realize that I just did it again. I just did it right there. It's every answer is a little story, because that sort of a story is almost like a geometric construct that surrounds a concept. You know, it allows you to triangulate on something that's very intellectually ephemeral. You know, you can't like point at justice the way that you can point at a chair. And you almost have to surround it so that people can see the shape of it in a narrative. I don't know if that makes any sense.
No, I think it does. Remember that old episode of Next Generation when, I don't know if you watched these like I did, but they had, they encountered this alien race. But they
I know exactly the one you're talking about.
You know, they would say like, Timo and Naka at Tanaka, right? Yeah. And they're just referring Star-Rock to some story.
At Tanaka. Yeah. Yeah, that's. I don't want to admit that I can quote that. Yeah.
Oh, you're even worse than me. Then that's impressive.
Tammy, were there any other questions that did come up? If people can still see this, were there any other interesting ones that popped up that I could try to just rapid fire some answers for?
One was, who do you see in your head when you write Dina? Dina.
I think of it as Dina. You know, I don't think of like an actress, but if I were to pick an actress, I would think, imagine like a cross between a younger Winona Ryder, Natalie Portman, Keira Knightley. You know, they tend to have that tear-shaped face and long hair and dark eyes. That's generally the thing. That's kind of what I think of when I think of Dina. But honestly, so much of her personality is her character that, you know, the physical outside almost doesn't matter as much.
Someone really wants to know if they won the golden ticket, if you would shave your beard.
Yeah, I'm auctioning off a favor on the fundraiser. And, you know, that's honestly, everybody else is way more attached to my beard than I am. People are like, oh, how did you get that beard? And I'm like, I was lazy forever, and I just don't shave it, and you get a beard. It's, you know, yeah. Right now the bidding's at something like, you know, $4,500. Yeah, that'd be an easy way for me to get out of satisfying the golden ticket winner.
Hey, I have another. I'm sorry, I keep asking questions. This is a really good one, though, as opposed to my other ones, which were kind of mediocre. Someone like George Lucas, okay, very creative, makes amazing stuff in his younger years. Now he's older, right? Now he's got infinite money, infinite resources, but he's the same person. How can a creative person stop being creative? Or what happened, you know? What's happening here?
I think there's a couple answers to that. One, although generally speaking, I agree with the general populace that the old Star Wars was mythic and the new Star Wars is less so. You could view it as, somebody once said, poetry is a young man's game. And all gender bias aside there, you do tend to get a lot of very brilliant young poets and very few brilliant older poets. Hmm. An older poet knows more about the craft, but poetry isn't just fancy prose. Poetry is something else. And that something else seems to reside a little bit more in like young, angry, kind of charged up, vivacious people. And I think you could make a similar argument for different sorts of other creative outputs.
Like Sting wrote so many amazing songs when he was young, and now he's infinite money, infinite resources, but he doesn't really write any new songs.
And there's a certain amount of, I think, the poison of success. If I was like starving hungry, maybe I would write faster. Maybe I would write leaner. Maybe I would be a little more charged up again. But I don't know if that's the case. Who's the other example I was thinking of? Oh, it could also be the fact that, like what you mentioned, the paralysis of choice. When you have, if it's the difference between writing a good solid sonnet or free verse. And honestly, free verse is an excuse for people to just vomit up whatever the hell they feel like and call it poetry. Now, there are good free verse poems and good free verse poets, but those poets know about line and language, as opposed to the other people that just don't give a care and just don't want to have to worry about figuring out what, an iamb is, or a dactyl or trochee, or how words work together and what sounds sweet. But if you're forced to operate within 14 lines and some metric and rhyme, those restraints force us to be clever in ways that we're not otherwise forced to be. And I think that early on, Lucas might have been Veronica. Hey,
Veronica.
Hey.
How's it going?
Good. We're interrupting him. He was telling a story.
I'm always talking. But I think that when you are constrained by your form, whether it be like budgetary concerns or the studio is breathing down your neck or you only have, 10 syllables in a line, you're forced to be clever in a way that if you can write 10 pages, you can kind of do whatever the hell you want. I think that burns a lot of successful types too. It's almost like the lack of, once you get big enough, people can't edit you effectively because you can just tell them to piss off.
Well, this concept is so counterintuitive that if you have infinite money, infinite resources, and infinite time, you cannot make something.
I
think they're scared of failure.
I
think once you hit it that big, they're scared to come out with something new and have an epic fail and look like jerks.
I bet you that's a huge part of it. Because when you are starting off, you can take these bold risks. Back before I was published, if I wanted to write a novel about, talking elephants, it didn't matter because I was nobody. And if my novel sucked, no one would ever know. But now, it's like, God, writing a talking elephant novel, what if people think that it's dumb as hell? I've embarrassed myself in front of a million people.
You had to pick talking elephants because my story was talking bears, basically. So
your story?
my NaNoWriMo.
I didn't know. I still want to beta read that for
you. Nope.
Oh, please.
Nope. No way. No.
I'm really good.
No. I know you're good. That's why.
I'm good. I'm good at reading things and giving feedback.
I know. Well, I have to finish it first.
Okay.
Man, yeah. I'm sorry. I totally came into this hangout and I was like, this is what cool. I think.
That's what hangouts are. You just hang out.
Yeah.
Whatever happens, happens.
My Google crashed though, so I have to kill and restart my page. So I'll try to be right back.
Okay. We'll wait.
Okay.
Patrick, there was one question that I thought was pretty good. It says, "Have you met any amateur writers that you mentor since you are a teacher?"
I don't get to teach creative writing. I did this last semester. I got to teach a creative writing class, and it was a hoot. And so I gave them some advice, and I told endless rambly stories at them, and explained how I screwed things up a bunch of times so that they didn't have to make those same mistakes. But I haven't found somebody. I'm certainly not in a mentor relationship by any means. I will admit I kind of have some of those impulses because I was a peer tutor. I was a writing tutor for like 12 years. Long before I was ever anything resembling a teacher, I met with people like every day and I talked about their writing and we talked about what might work better and what might, you know, be holding the story back. And so I love to talk with people about their stuff. And it's like one of my very, very few skills. But it's rare. I don't get a chance to actually put that skill to use with other professional writers because if I was an editor, I would have my authors and then I would give them advice. But as a peer of another author, you don't read their book and say, oh, this was great, but you know what? The three places that you really stepped in it. Although honestly, I think that I read a book and I'm like, this was brilliant. And if they'd fixed these two things, it would have been super, super brilliant. Or sometimes it's brilliant. And then there's one mistake that's like chewing a grain of sand inside a lovely sandwich. It doesn't matter how good the sandwich is. Like you eat a piece of grit in it and you can't enjoy the sandwich anymore. And so I'm trying to figure out where to put that type of thing that I like to do because I can't use it in my professional author life. And most of the authors that I really enjoy, they don't need any mentoring.
Well, maybe when your kid grows up, turn into a writer and you can,
Oh God, I can think of no better way to destroy our
Well, Victoria, what were you talking about tonight on Sword and Laser? What was your topic?
Veronica. And we were talking Veronica. That's okay. I get that all the time. Let's see. What do we talk about tonight? We're reading Rule 34 by Charles Stross right now, which is an excellent book. It deals, of course, with Rule 34, which is the internet rule that if there's... You know,
if it exists, there's porn of it.
If it exists, there's porn of it somewhere. So it deals. It's kind of like a crime story. It's like a mystery crime novel set in a not too distant future, and it's pretty good. It was a slow burn in the beginning, but now I'm getting much more into it. So I'm about 65% of the way through. We're reading that. Our alternate pick is Empire State, which is another great one. Kind of similar in concept to China Mieville's The City and the City, but it definitely takes a different kind of spin on that alternate universe kind of theme. And then I'm still reading 1Q84 by Murakami right now as well.
You know, I've heard things, is that how you pronounce the name, Murakami?
Mm-hmm.
People have been recommending that off and on to me for a couple of years. Should I bump that up on my reading list?
Yeah, I mean, that one just came out, so that's it's huge. I mean, I think it's like a 900-page book. Well, you know a thing or two about long books, so maybe that won't be a... Maybe that won't turn you off to it. What's that?
Have you read anything else by that author?
Yes, I've read, it's not the, I always get confused with it's not the Wind Up Bird. Is it the Wind Up Bird Chronicle?
Wind Up Girl by Bacigalupi?
No, not Bacigalupi. Let me pull up his list of books. He's written so many books. It's hard to keep up with them sometimes. Okay, so I have read Hard Boiled Wonderland and the End of the World, and I've read The Wind Up Bird Chronicle, which is different from The Wind Up Girl by Paolo Bacigalupi. And 1Q84 is the most recent one. But yeah, he's a great writer, but the books are definitely complicated. They go into a lot of different storylines, and a lot of them have yet to converge where I'm at in the book right now. So I'm listening to the audiobook as well, and it's good. There's some crazy stuff that's happening, and it's getting more exciting the further I go along, of course, they're supposed to do.
That's I should really give him a try. I didn't even know it was a him, actually. Mm-hmm. Yeah, people have been mentioning that author's books to me for a while. I should probably get on the stick. Has anyone here read Harry Connor? He wrote a trilogy, game. I had him right here by my desk. A Game of Cages was the second one. Circle of Enemies.
No, I haven't.
The first one was Game of Fire. He was kind of like the new urban. They were pitching him as the next Jim Butcher.
Oh, okay. I think I've seen this book before in the store.
Yeah. And Veronica, you guys were talking about Grave Witch.
Yes.
and which I picked up and I read. And it's interesting because it's so hard to read urban fantasy without, for me at least, without holding it up to the mm-hmm. Dresden Files and going, but
there's a lot of comparisons for sure.
Right, but with the this Harry Connelly one, which I will admit I just read all three books in the last 2 days, it was a very interesting because it didn't do the private investigator thing. It didn't do like the whole noir thing, which a lot mm-hmm. of them kind of fall into that. He made his own choices and the character was very different and the world was pretty dark and almost nihilistic, almost like touching on the border of Lovecraftian, because there are things out there and if they got in, it would be terrible. Mm-hmm. And there are some people lurking in the shadows, working in secret to keep humanity safe. And they do terrible things to keep humanity safe. And I found them really interesting.
Like, ooh, I'll have to add those to my list.
I'm just really curious to talk to somebody about them because they did make so many interesting choices compared to Jim Butcher's stuff. They're very unique and very, very interestingly written. And I just need a sounding board or a second opinion on what somebody else thought of them.
Do you ever, you read your books so fast. Do you ever like read one slow, like a good piece of chocolate and savor it and savor the words? Or do you just, can you not? You just rip through them.
I save that for my book. I just read very, very fast. I don't know where exactly that comes from. Actually, I think it might, and this is total spitball theory on my part, I think it might stem from the fact that I have just a touch of dyslexia, which means that I had trouble learning to read a little bit when I was a kid. But I think I read differently than other people. I think most people read a word as a word, as a collection of letters, whereas I read a word as a single discrete unit. And that means that I think I'm able to read a lot faster. It also means that I am useless when it comes to being confronted with the pronunciation of a new word or a name. I end up just crippled when any sort of unfamiliar name comes up or a word. I still don't know how to pronounce chaotic, quixotic.
Oh yeah, I don't know how to say that word either.
I think it's quixotic.
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 But it should be chaotic for Don Quixote.
Like Quixote, right?
Yeah. But yeah, I end up being really blindsided by unfamiliar words. But at this point in my life, it's rare that I run into too many unfamiliar words.
Once you see the word like a Chinese symbol, You know, just,
I bet you, it's,
you just
it's
suck little, it in at once.
Yeah, it's a little similar to that. I imagine, like I said, this is my total crackpot theory about how I read fast.
I was going to mention, urban fantasy-wise, one book that I really love was War of the Flowers by Tad Williams, which is actually an urban fantasy novel.
That's a great one it came out before urban fantasy was a thing.
Right.
I did. I really enjoyed that. If only for the one fairy. Now, what is the official policy on cussing in these things?
No, it's fine. Go for it.
Okay, because yeah. This one fairy comes in, and it's a little Tinkerbell fairy. And it comes in, and it cusses and cusses and cusses, and it constantly says, "Shinions." That's what it swears, and I'm like, what a brilliant... I mean, because I can't think of anything worse.
A smell combination.
Right, that's what a horrible, vulgar combination. I love the book. Just for that,
fairies get away with so much. Like the Wee Freeman and Terry Pratchett's novels and the Discworld novels, all they do is swear the whole time, too.
Yeah.
It's like, apparently, if you're a fairy, you can get away with it all.
Mm-hmm.
I read those to my kids at night.
Oh, those great books. Actually, the key is dialect. If mm-hmm. you put something in dialect, you can put any terrible word in a book. I used the worst curse... The worst cuss of all in my book twice, and it was okay because it was in dialect. Nobody even ever spotted it.
Really?
Was it in a song or a poem?
It was, here's the secret. One was the pig herder at the end of the book, and the other is in a slight, like, pronunciation dialect of a title. It's in the beginning of the book. But I did. I didn't even think of it, because I tucked so many little things into the book over the years, and then it was published, and I read it again, and I'm like, oh wow, I did. The big C is in this book.
You dropped a C.
I was wondering if that's what it was.
It is. I mean, I'm not too bashful. We pulled the F-bomb out. I used it once in the first book, and then we pulled it, for good reasons.
Well, that's always an interesting question in terms of swearing in fantasy kind of books, because does it take people away from the immersion of that story? Like, do those swear words exist in that world? Does it bring people too much back into the present? Or is it something that can flow into that kind of narrative?
It's a huge problem, in my opinion, if you are a word-based, immersive second world fantasy author. Because cussing is something that everyone does. It feels very immediate and colloquial. And so it feels very present day, even though, you know, f**k is like a really good old Anglo-Saxon word, that, you know, folks have been using for like 600 years, but it feels very modern. And so it will, even though it's a good old fashioned word, ye old, you know, but
the old timey F word.
Yeah, it does. It breaks the immersion for people who are reading these secondary world fantasy, in the same way, in my opinion, that a word like comrade has the potential of doing, because mm-hmm. it reeks to most U.S. people of like Soviet Russia, or the name Annabelle, because to the U.S. reader it sounds like a French name, and there's no France in this constructed world. That's a weird language thing that I think about a lot, because you want people to be able to cuss, because that's very important to any mm-hmm. language and dialogue. But fake cussing, nothing sounds faker than fake cussing.
Well, that reminds me of
Except for frack.
Frack doesn't sound, frack it awesome. Sounds fake to me.
I love frack.
Like, that took me out of the BSG storyline, because every time I heard frack, I knew what they were trying to say or wanted to say. And the only time I think I've heard cursing in a TV show that made sense to me was in Firefly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He dodged it very cleverly there.
I thought that was great. That was you knew what they were saying. You couldn't understand them, so it wasn't funny. It was like, oh, they're just doing it in a different language that I don't know. I don't speak Mandarin, so I don't know what they're saying now. No, there you go. So you knew exactly what was happening.
It was tough to listen to it.
Really? Oh, that's great.
And I hear their accents were really bad too.
Oh yeah, they're horrible. And sometimes I knew what they were trying to say, and it sounded like it's worse when I actually know what they were trying, how far off they were.
I do that. I use that. No, I didn't use it. I stole that for the second book in a few places. You know, where people curse, but they pull different terms out of different languages. But it is. It's still running that line. Even frack did it. It eventually you grew used to it, but initially it did. It felt very fake. There was a second one that I think, a second series that managed to pull it off, but it's ancient, Red Dwarf. Smeg is a great swear word.
I'm going to use that one more. That's Smeg. A good idea.
It just feels awful. Yeah.
Cool. Well, what's coming up next week for you, Veronica?
Oh, for me on Sword and Laser? Well, we're wrapping up Rule 34. And picking the next book, we have to go back into the realm of lasers at this point. I've let my sword rule go on for too long now. My dictatorship must come to an end, and we'll get a good spaceship story in there somewhere. So if you guys have any suggestions, let us know.
Did you guys already talk about Peter F. Hamilton?
We haven't done a Peter F. Hamilton yet. We've done a few classics. We've done Heinlein. We've done a lot of good ones. Well, you know, Orson Scott Card. If you can, I would consider that classic at this point, probably. We need something more, a little more. Are we thinking of doing Le Guin, Ursula Le Guin? Because, ooh. But she kind of straddles the line for me between sci-fi fantasy. So,
yeah. Which Heinlein did you do?
We did The Moon is a Harsh Mistress.
Yeah.
I mean, make sure that is Heinlein, right? Sometimes I get Heinlein confused with, okay.
I haven't read much.
Yeah, Heinlein.
I haven't read much much sci-fi lately. Altered Carbon.
Oh, yeah, that's on our list of ones to look at. I actually have a copy of that here that I need to start reading.
People have been pushing Morgan on me for a long time, and I picked it up, and this is a terrible thing for me to say, is... a big book writer, but I picked it up once, and it's fairly hefty, you know, 500 pages. Picked it up, and I opened it, and the type was a little small, and I was like, oh, long book. I don't know if I'm in the mood for this, but it was brilliant. I really enjoyed that.
That's why you gotta read it on Kindle. You just make the words look a little bigger. It's nice. You can trick yourself that way.
The sense of accomplishment.
People get really mad at me when I'm like, I'm 65% done with this book. And they're like, stop talking like that. That's not how people read. You're not supposed to know the exact percentage value. It's like, whatever. Welcome to the future, right?
Yeah.
I make my text so big on my Kindle. It's kind of embarrassing, really. When I'm on the plane, I hope people don't see because I feel like an old person. I make a giant.
You gotta do what you gotta do.
Yeah. It's not good.
Hey, we forgot to ask Tony about the show coming up for, I guess, Twit Photo this week.
Yeah, Tony, what's up? Over.
Sorry, I was muted. We have our Twit Photo Guest Quest winner tomorrow. Robbie Cavanaugh? He's driving.
Oh, yeah, that guy.
Yeah, so he'll be in studio, actually, so...
Oh, he's a nice guy.
Yeah, he's cool.
What time is that?
Tomorrow between 1 and 1:30 p.m.
Awesome.
Pacific.
Well, sorry, Tony, we're keeping you up so late, but this is all good. I kind of want it to be recorded, you know? It's okay.
You want this included in the show, Trey?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
This is the extended director's cut version.
The deep cuts.
Veronica, by the way, I just wanted to say how much I really enjoyed the Vaginal Fantasy Hangout.
Yes!
I showed up and I was kind of like, of course, you guys, I think you absolutely have to keep that name, by the way.
Thank you.
Yeah, great.
And I showed up and it was the first one of these that I'd ever watched. And it was terribly engaging. And honestly, I don't know if I would have been brave enough to to say yes here to Trey if I hadn't seen that first, because you know, you guys were having such a good time. And I saw it, and I'm like, oh, I so want a piece of that. I want to, like, get online and talk about cool things with people now.
Yeah, it's really fun. We had a blast with it. That was our first one, and we're recording the next one on February 27th with our new book.
It was great. My wife loved it, too. I put it on for her. You know, I put it on the iPad. And she goes, oh, my gosh, it's really good. And she started writing down books, and she's doing all that same stuff, too. And so she's... You have another subscriber. You should turn it into a podcast.
I think we probably will at some point. We just enjoy having it on Google Plus so much that it's. I don't think we've gotten to that next step yet. It was kind of like a trial, and now that we know that it worked, it's already been viewed like 40,000 times on YouTube, which is terrifying for me. I'm not used to that kind of... What?
I think the name is what sold it. I read Google for the first time this week because of that.
Nice. Yeah, we were trending on Twitter for a while, too, and I think they took it down because it had the word vaginal in it. But it's fun. It gets people's attentions, and people shouldn't be scared of words like that. It's silly, but we're having a great time with it.
Naming this thing out when we had a penal fantasy, but I didn't think it would quite have much allure.
I actually made a joke about that, too. I'm like, I could totally get some guys together. And as soon as I'm like, no, four dudes, or like, four most likely like kind of beardy, heavy set fantasy dudes talking about penile fantasy.
The thing is, it doesn't even exist as a genre. I don't think there are that many like, you know, paranormal romances that are geared towards dudes. Are there?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you can make a good art. We could just spend a whole thing talking about Harry Dresden running around with his staff.
There you go. There you go. Harry Dresden. Love that man.
That long coat.
You can call it This Week in Penile Fantasy. Twipf. Twipf. Yeah, twipf. Twipf. I like it.
Hey, you talked to Ernst Klein, the Ready Player One guy on your show yesterday with Brushwood, right?
Yeah, on Game On my other podcast, we had Ernie Klein, author of Ready Player One, and he was fantastic. He talked about all sorts of like future and video game stuff. He talked about his book and how they're working on the movie, and it was a lot of fun. He's so knowledgeable about pop culture and memes and just everything going back. He's like Wikipedia in the brain. It's crazy. And I was just totally astonished. And I loved that book. I thought it was just fantastic. It was super fun pop culture fest. And I highly recommend it. It's a good quick read.
Yeah. I feel a strange, like, I got to read a very early copy of it. And a lot of people send me ARCs. And I'm so hesitant to blurb because... If I kind of like a book, I don't feel good about blurbing it because I don't want people to pick up a book thinking that I've wholeheartedly recommended it. Mm-hmm. When what I've really done is politely phrased a blurb so that I'm not lying, which happens a lot in the publishing industry, unfortunately. And so I got his book and I read it. And I'm like, finally, something that I can like enthusiastically, you know, like say... I can't remember what my blurb was, but I wanted it to see again. I'm going to cuss here on your podcast. It was what I sent to Ernie in an email. I got it off his editor. My whole email was just your book is so f-ing good. I can't stand it. And I wanted that to be the promotional blurb on the cover, but they wouldn't do it.
Yeah. I think that would have done well. Yeah.
This, I am on, I'm about 2 hours to the end, so I'm excited.
Oh, so you're listening to the Will Wheaton narrated audiobook version then?
Yes.
It's very good.
How is the Wheaton audio on that? I've never heard him do an audiobook.
Fantastic. He's great.
He's got a nice, deep voice, and he's engaging, and, you know, who doesn't like Will?
He gets to self-reference himself in the book, too.
Yeah.
Which is hilarious.
Did you hear him sing Soft Kitty today to his sick wife?
No.
He posted a video of him singing Soft Kitty to his sick wife today.
That's very cute.
I was a little afraid to click on the link because I don't know that song. I I was afraid of the context.
No, it's fine. It's kind of a joke about Big Bang Theory, I think, because I don't know if it's outside of that joke.
Pat, you don't watch Big Bang Theory.
Here's the confession. I do not, like, own a TV that is hooked up to cable. Let's flesh it out. I'm also the only person in the world. Does anyone recognize what this is?
It's a cell phone.
Ah, yes.
That is a flip phone.
It's a flip phone. Look at that.
Yeah. Clamshell, yeah.
At some point I fell off the tech wagon and I've been kind of quiet and embarrassed of it ever since.
Patrick, let me help you.
I
can help you with these things. I have the means.
I really do. And you know, what's so funny is when I was watching the Vaginal Fantasy podcast, I saw your mic and I'm like, oh, I want a really good mic too.
Yeah, all the girls were like, what camera do you use? What mic do you use? We need to get those. Our shots look like terrible. I was like, I'll help you. I got the deets.
I need a little bit of that. If I'm not even on Twitter, I've shamed myself.
It's okay. You're on Google Plus.
Yeah, you're the king of Google Plus.
That's very technologically advanced.
Oh, that's right. I am the king of Google Plus.
You're ahead of the curve.
Yeah.
You don't sound convinced. It's like, I guess.
I mean, I was there with MySpace. You know, I was right on top of that. And ever since that fell off the map, I'm like, you know, maybe being cutting edge is not what I want to be.
You're in Goodreads, too.
I have a ton of fun on Goodreads. As soon as I saw you guys there, like, having fun and talking about books, I was like, I so want to do that. But the reason that it was so cool is that you guys have the freedom to really say whatever you want about whatever books you read. Whereas, you know, and I was going to, like, send you an email that was like, so if, you know, affirmative action ever makes you take a man onto the show, I would love to be a part of that podcast.
You are welcome anytime.
But the difficulty is it's extraordinarily bad form for me to ever be publicly critical of another author's book. Even if I like it, if I'm then critical about it, and maybe it's just part of it is me being Midwestern, but I know that that's not a cool thing for me to do. Even if it's justified or even if it's meant in a polite way, I don't know if I could be that honest, as honest as you guys get to be on that podcast. So I might just be dead weight.
Well, if you ever write a paranormal romance or a vaginal fantasy, you're welcome to come on the show and talk about it.
Oh, now see, the gauntlet has been thrown down.
Or a short story even. We'll take a short story.
Actually.
Oh, I see it in his eyes. He has something.
I have a novella that I'm so proud of that, I might send something your way. I would love a chance to talk about that on the Vaginal Fantasy podcast.
Perfect. It's a date.
Okay. Awesome.
Nice.
Well, cool. Pat, I'm sure you got to run. I'm sure you have something else to do, something great to make, something awesome to create and bring forth into this mortal coil. And yes, I feel like we're keeping you from it.
The stable of nubile young cat girls, they get antsy if I don't visit them every once in a while. And I should go feed the poor or whatever it is I'm supposed to do. Trey, I can't thank you enough. I end up a little socially starved these days, given that so many of my people have left Stevens Point. And this has been like such a treat getting to hang out with cool folks on the internet. So I feel like less of a Luddite and I get to meet some cool folks too.
Well, no, thank you. I was really honored. I'll never forget it. And I appreciate you very much. So thanks for your time.
Yeah, well, don't ever hesitate to tap me if you want to do this again in a while. It was an absolute hoot. and talking about art with another person who does art, but not necessarily written art, has been a total eye-opener. It was an absolute treat for me.
Oh, well, thank you. And thanks for coming, Veronica. It was nice to see you.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm happy I was able to jump in and say hello.
Yes, and you set up a future vaginal fantasy.
There you go. So always working. Awesome. That's
yeah,
me.
I didn't even think of that would fit until you mentioned that. Now I'm going to get back on that horse tomorrow.
All right. Yeah, Felicia will be stoked, I'm sure.
Cool. Wonderful.
Okay. Well, thanks, everybody. Thanks for staying late, Tony and Tammy and Dave and everybody. That's great. You guys are awesome. So thank you.
Thanks so much.
Great show.
Okay, I'm going to bail out, guys. Bye.